Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
It's that time of century again, a little American ritual all about who's, what, where, and when. A monster every decade snapshot of the USA we call the census.
The further adventures of Larry Cogswell, official census taker. He is America.
That's right, there's nothing more American than census takers, and the adventure of the census is our focus all week as the constitutionally empowered census taker ground troops prepare to deploy to a neighborhood near you with all their little questions and one big one. Can a nation this big truly know itself? Find out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Monday, March 15th, and the census and national self-knowledge is our focus this morning. Lynn Scherr joins me today. Good morning.
Morning, John. I think you're a little obsessed with the census. I'm quite enjoying this.
I love them.
Let's get a check on the rest of the morning's top news. Two U.S. embassy workers in Mexico are dead in what's believed to be the first attack on American officials and their families by the country's powerful drug cartels. Gunmen believed to be linked to drug traffickers shot a consulate worker and her husband in the border town of Juarez with their newborn baby in the back seat. They also killed the husband of another consular employee and wounded his two young children. Earlier, we spoke to Joan Grillo, who writes about Mexico for Time magazine. He told us Juarez is fast becoming one of the most dangerous cities in the world.
Worse than Baghdad, worse than Mogadishu, or worse than some violent American cities like New Orleans.
President Obama has expressed outrage at what he called the brutal murders.
A Defense Department official is under investigation for hiring private contractors to gather intelligence on suspected insurgents in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Our partner, the New York Times, reports the contractors sent the intelligence to military units who used it for airstrikes. It's against U.S. policy to use contractors as spies. Here at home, let the counting begin. Let my obsession unfold. More than 120 million census forms begin arriving in mailboxes around the country today. The once-in-a-decade population count will be used to divvy up congressional seats and more than $400 billion in federal aid. And we're joined now by Erwin Clare, team leader and senior partnership specialist for the Brooklyn, New York Census Bureau. Good morning, Erwin.
Good morning.
So are all your troops wired up with GPS devices, walkie-talkies, and fancy computers to do this mother of all data downloads?
No, we're not.
It's just a basic
load? No, we're not.
You're just walking the streets?
No. We're not doing that at this point yet. The walking the street is primarily outreach at this point. That point that you're talking about would be the enumeration process where people go back to people's households who did not respond to the census, and they won't have GPS. And they won't be wired up like that.
The retro look at the census coming right up. Erwin Clare, stay with us. We're going to be exploring that in just a moment.
John, President Obama continues his role today as salesman for health care reform. He'll head to Ohio later this morning for a speech as the effort to line up enough votes continues on Capitol Hill. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs is confident.
We'll have the votes when the House votes, I think within the next week.
But the top Democratic vote counter in the House says there are not enough votes at this time to pass the bill.
Last week, it was U.S. governors talking about education reform. Today, President Obama will outline his proposals to rewrite the No Child Left Behind law with less emphasis on standardized testing. Time to fill out your brackets. The country's biggest office pool, March Madness, kicks off this week. The college basketball tournament gets underway. The top seeds for the NCAA tournament are Kansas, Kentucky, Duke, and Syracuse. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down this morning. The Dow gets underway at 10,624. The S&P starts at 1,149, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,367 a little later this morning. Coming up, a look at the economic consequences of breastfeeding after 6 months, which is the recommended time for new moms. We'll also spend time talking about the census. We're going to learn later which communities in America are shrinking, and we want your take. Do you see population shifts in your community? Be the eyes in your town. Tell us what's going on at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our site, thetakeaway.org. In a minute, mandatory census takers. It's as American as apple pie. Good morning and happy Monday to everyone. Lynn, you know, the census The history of the census goes back to the Roman Empire, but the regularity of U.S. censuses is a bit of an innovation for our particular democracy. What's the first census you remember?
I certainly remember as a kid having the census taker come to my house.
Sure.
Probably in the 50s is what I remember. I'm sure it was before that. I have to tell you, though, I love the census because when I did some research on my family, do you know that all the old census records are online?
That's amazing.
And you can go look stuff up and find out about your grandparents, where they lived, and it's cool stuff.
It's a huge data set, and it's about to get bigger. And you know, the census kind of sneaks up on you each decade without warning, kind of when you least expect it.
Come see to shining sea. No place like your own backyard, that's for sure.
Hello?
Excuse me?
excuse me. Yeah, right. I've got a few questions for you.
Hey, watch the daffodils there, pal.
Sorry. What's your name?
Albert O'Malkovinoshevsky.
O'Malkovinoshevsky. All righty. Nice big place you've got here, Mr. O'Malkovinoshevsky. How many of you live here?
Me, my wife, my kids, you know. Hey, why are you asking this stuff?
And their ages, please?
My wife is 34.
Okay.
My oldest son is 17. Then we have an 11-year-old, my daughter, 9, and a new 7-month-old baby girl.
Right. Girl 0.
Excuse me?
Your baby girl is a 0 now. You own this place or rent?
Hey, who are you?
Just call me Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3 of your constitution, fella. Now, any of the people staying with you, are they Asian Indian?
No.
Chinese?
No.
Filipino?
No.
How about Samoans?
Hey, look, what's this all about?
I need your phone number, please.
I'm not giving you my phone number.
You better, or you could lose representation, political power, you could lose the chance at billions of dollars in federal revenue.
I beg your pardon?
Almost done. Mr. Malkovinoshevsky. What kind of a name is that? Irish? Polish? Hispanic?
It's Samoan.
Really?
Right.
Hey, whoa. It is un-American to lie to me, pal.
Look, I'm about ready to call the police here.
Police? They'd give you the ticket. I'm Larry Cogswell, official census taker.
I am America.
You know, it is fun and irresistible to make fun of the census, but there's nothing more American. And here to talk about it, we welcome back Erwin Clare, team leader and senior partnership specialist for the Brooklyn Census Bureau, out there doing all the enumeration in some of the more challenging neighborhoods to actually do a census count in. Is that right, Erwin?
That is absolutely correct, Larry. And by the way, there's no Larry on our team, all right?
There's no Larry on your team. Okay, yeah. Don't call me Larry Cogsworth. He's a figment of my imagination. Also joining us is Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Are you a pro census guy, Sam, or do you buy into this whole fear of government that the census stories are filled with this time around?
No, most of the people who are afraid of government benefit from the census. As you mentioned earlier, the census is used to dole out about $400 or $500 billion in federal assistance, Medicaid assistance based on income, population, to some extent enforces civil rights and anti-discrimination laws. And the most important thing, perhaps, is that the reapportionment of congressional and legislative districts, ultimately the Electoral College itself, is based on the population estimates of the U.S. Census. So it is very important to the way our democracy runs.
Originally, Sam, in the Constitution, it was really only about determining the representation, how many congressional districts. But it, as you've said, has evolved to basically determine the formulas for distribution of almost all federal revenue.
That's true. Under the Constitution, the census is taken every 10 years for reapportionment purposes to make sure that we adhere basically to the one man, one person, one vote dictum. A lot of other questions have been added on over the years to help us guide federal programs and federal policies. This year, though, the census form is only 10 questions long for everyone. In past years, there was usually a long form sent to some people. Most of the others got the short form. This year, it's 10 for everyone, because most of those other questions have been replaced by the annual American Community Survey, which gives a much more timely and accurate picture of who we are as a country.
We're getting too big to just do a census once every 10 years. Erwin Clare, senior specialist for the Brooklyn Census Bureau, what are you doing to try to convince people to maybe disclose more information and not to slam their doors in your faces?
Well, basically, one of the things that the 2010 census has invested heavily in this time around is our partnership approach, where many people are employed representing the communities from whence they are to form relationships with community groups, community-based organizations, businesses, to help to supplement the process of getting to especially the hard-to-count region. We find that when we have persons from the community or of the community communicating the message, it helps to supplement the process as opposed to just having government employees like ourselves articulating the importance of census. So we have a strong relationship with the clergy, a strong relationship with community-based organizations and businesses as part of our outreach to the community.
And you've even teamed up with Steve Harvey, the comedian.
Well, Steve, the Steve Harvey Show is one such entity that the Census Bureau has partnered with. And just today as we speak, you know, he's broadcasting live from Crown Heights at one of our centers here. And there are several hundred people are out to hear him.
Right. And an effort all to try to counter this kind of fear that really came into our inbox last week from one of our listeners. Listen to this.
It's amazing. The Census Bureau is going to register probably about 25 million illegal aliens and undocumented workers. Therefore, the communities and towns and cities can get enough tax dollars that the federal government will dispense back to them so that they can support the illegal aliens.
Sam Roberts, how do you evaluate that level of cynicism from our listener Rick there?
Not only cynical, it's unconstitutional. The Constitution of the United States says the census counts all residents of the United States. It doesn't differentiate between immigrants and not legal or not all residents, and that's what the census is simply supposed to do.
Erwin Clare, do you find people who distinguish between undocumented immigrants and American citizens?
Yeah, without a doubt, especially in the areas that we cover here, it's largely an immigrant group. So they come with their cultures, maybe that they had a great distrust of government from where they're from. Many are here who may be immigration challenged, may also be in homes where they are legal residents.
But it does say residents. It says in the Constitution, residents, and that's the issue. Erwin Clare, thanks so much. Talking about the challenges there in Brooklyn, that's his territory, and Sam Roberts, urban affairs correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. What's at stake in the census on The Takeaway? And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some other stories we're following. Lynn?
The U.S. is officially reacting to the killings this weekend of staff connected to the U.S. consulate in Juarez in Mexico. The State Department says it has authorized dependents of its officials based in Mexican border cities to leave. President Obama expressed outrage at the three killings and said the U.S. would help track down the perpetrators. President Obama is also trying to nail down enough votes to pass his health care reform plan. He's in Ohio this morning with another sales pitch. White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs says the president will touch on familiar themes in a speech this morning.
Going through why reform is important, going through what it will do the minute he signs the legislation for on behalf of millions of Americans, discussing what happens again if we decide now is not the time.
Meanwhile, Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid's wife is out of the hospital after being badly injured in a car accident. Landra Reid suffered a broken neck and back, but doctors say she is not at risk of paralysis.
NATO says an early morning rocket attack on the U.S. military base at Bagram, Afghanistan, killed one person today. We'll have more details on that story later on in the show. And back at home, Alice is at the top of the box office.
That's the wrong Alice!
You're absolutely Alice. I don't know you anywhere.
I'd know him anywhere.
That's a clip from the top grossing movie this weekend, Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. The movie earned around $62 million in box office takings and is number one for the second straight week. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, March Madness begins. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen takes us through the brackets.
Hey, you want that to go?
I'm Lynn Scherer in for Celeste Headlee today. And ever since the financial crisis began, there's been lots of talk about financial reform. Well, later today, Connecticut Democratic Senator Christopher Dodd, in his role as chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, unveils a new and broad financial overhaul bill. You might think everyone would welcome this latest attempt at reform. You would be wrong. Joining us to map out its path is our friend Louise Story, Wall Street and finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Morning, Louise.
Good morning.
So what's in the bill? What do we expect to see out of this? And give us the layout.
So it's been broadly telegraphed. Of course, we don't know. The bill won't be released until 2 p.m. today. But if you were on Twitter last night, you would have seen the press secretary for the Senate Banking Committee on there tweeting that they were on track. What I think is notable is what's not in this bill. If you remember, in January, President Obama came out with a very dramatic proposal where he would separate proprietary trading. He would not let banks do this kind of risky trading or own hedge funds. That's not in this bill. Also not in this
Why?
Bill.
Why is it not in the bill?
Well, Dodd will do an interview today. I think that'll be a top question for him. Some people have said it's perhaps the reason is because it would be too divisive. It might not pass, and it was proposed by the president very late. The other thing the president has proposed since last summer that's not in this bill is an independent agency for consumer protection. This bill is expected to put the Consumer Protection Agency inside the Federal Reserve.
And how is the Fed going to be taking this?
Well, the Fed is getting an increase and a decrease in its powers in different aspects of this bill. So getting consumer protection is certainly a win for them. Consumer advocates are very skeptical because, you know, the Fed did not fully protect consumers during the run-up in the housing bubble, so people are skeptical. The Fed will be losing some of its regulatory power over smaller bank holding companies. The other thing that is supposed to be in this bill is the New York Fed, which is very close to Wall Street, is going to be separated a bit from the banks, and there won't be able to be bank executives on the board of the New York Fed. That's a very big change for them. So the Fed kind of is a mixed bag. It gains some powers, loses some. The consumer protection one is controversial.
And how do the consumers do out of all this?
Again, it will depend on whether the Fed really steps up and uses the greater resources it gets to watch out for them. And the problem is the Fed will have a dual rule. One, on the one hand, the Fed will have to make sure banks are safe and sound. But on the other hand, they'll have to make sure that consumers are not being ripped off. Mm-hmm. And those two roles can come into conflict. Sometimes you want protection for consumers that costs money to banks and hurts their profits and might eat away at their capital levels. So that's the conflict.
You know, in some sense, this is about Dodd, too. Is he a captive of the industry that he's overseen
it's
for
from
so
Connecticut.
Long? Right. Or is this his kind of populist last stand and it's going to really test his power in the Senate?
This is his moment to show whether he, you know, stands up for the people and for consumer protection or whether he's a lot closer to Wall Street.
I realize you don't know the specifics of the bill at this point, Louise, but from what you know and from the mood in Congress, will what the senator wants pass?
So he's moving ahead without Republicans. They had tried to reach an agreement, and he just threw it out the door last week and said, I'm going ahead without them. But they've got 60 legislative days or so. And what Democrats are saying is that there's some Republicans who will probably swing over and support this. It looks like it might even have a better chance than health care in some people's view of getting Republican support. So we'll have to see.
And you said 2 o'clock it's being released?
Yes.
Okay. We'll be watching.
Stay tuned.
Okay. John?
Our other big story, of course, sports. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen is here, Takeaway Sports contributor. The brackets are set. The four top seeds are clear. Kansas, actually some friends from Kansas actually visited me yesterday, and they brought little kid KU shirts for all our kids to wear. Kansas is the number one seed. Who are the other three?
I don't know if America's ready, first of all, but for what's going to happen this year. Syracuse is in the number one seed.
Not a surprise.
Duke is in the number one seed.
Not a surprise.
And who's the last?
Kentucky,
correct. Yeah. Well, that's not a surprise at all because Kentucky is actually one of my favorites to get to the Final Four without a doubt. This is a really tough year, and the reason why I said I don't know if America is ready is because this has been a topsy-turvy year, particularly at the top of the bracket. The top 10 teams have been switching in and out, but in that topsy-turvy, it's been consistent. So what you're going to see is a lot of the bubble teams and the teams that just got in they don't have the same level of talent. You're not going to see as many upsets this year, but you'll see some of these top teams that have been doing this dance at the top get to the finals.
Is that because of the way they manipulated the brackets? In other words, is the selection process all about preventing upsets or what?
If you're Kansas, then you're angry about the way the bracket's been set up because you have the most treacherous road, but you have the longest run at number one all season and the number one seed overall. If you're Duke and if you're one of these people that loves to hate Duke, then you're going to really hate Duke this year because they're the low the worst number one seed, but they have the easiest road to the finals. So there is some magic and some trickery with the brackets.
So who's the Butler University this year? Who's the dark horse, the strange town? Does Gonzaga have a chance? Does Xavier have a chance?
You know, right now I like Cornell, and I'll explain why. They have the best three-point percentage in the country, and they have this guy, Jason Witten, who has played really good against top talent. He scored 24 against Kansas earlier this year. And I like Cornell to do some upsets early on. Siena is another one that's primed to get some upsets, and same with Marquette.
Now, last night at the supermarket, across the fish counter, they were having a heated argument, Syracuse versus Kansas. And the guy who was handling the tuna was saying that Kansas all the way, you can't stop Kansas. There's no way to stop Kansas. And the other guys in the fish were saying, I'm with Syracuse, but they're a heartbreaker.
Syracuse is a heartbreaker. I love Syracuse. So is Rhode Island, who didn't get in, and they broke my heart by not getting in.
Yeah.
But I think when you look at teams that have that come in on a roll, that's what you look for. If they came in on a roll, they came in on a win streak, those are the teams that I would go for and that would predict.
And Kansas has
come in on a roll.
And if you take the last part of the season, Syracuse is that way, although they have some injuries to worry about.
Syracuse is going to have a difficult role. Their center, Onowaku, he is not healthy, and I would not pick Syracuse if he's not healthy.
All right, take it to the bank. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor. Those are your takeouts. Coming up, we're going to talk with New York Times reporter Mark Mazzetti about his lead story in the paper this morning. A U.S. Defense Department official has been using private contractors to track and kill militants in Afghanistan and Pakistan. We'll talk more details in just a few minutes.
I'm Lynn Scherer, filling in for Celeste Headlee, and coming up, a Defense Department official using private contractors to track and kill militants in Afghanistan and Pakistan? It may sound like something out of a Robert Ludlum novel, but according to our partner, the New York Times, it is really happening. Find out more in just a few minutes. And here are some of the other news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Mexican drug cartels are believed to be behind the ambush and murder of three people connected to the U.S. embassy in the border town of Juarez. U.S. consulates across northern Mexico have begun sending family members out of the area because of concerns about rising violence. Back home, more than 100 million census forms begin hitting mailboxes today. The once-a-decade population count is used to decide congressional districts and more than $400 billion in federal aid.
Officials in Yemen say they've launched a second day of airstrikes against al-Qaeda hideouts. Yemen's defense ministry says a strike yesterday killed two militants and preempted an imminent al-Qaeda attack. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, there was an early morning rocket attack at the Bagram airfield, the largest U.S. military hub in the country. NATO says one person was killed in that attack. And in Iraq, a suicide car bomber killed at least seven people in the city of Fallujah. This comes as Prime Minister Maliki began talks on forming a new coalition government. Toyota plans a news conference this morning to release its findings on that alleged sudden acceleration of a Prius on a California highway. You may have seen the pictures. The out-of-control Prius was being brought to a halt by a highway patrol officer. The car owner's attorney says it's no surprise that investigators have not been able to replicate the incident.
There's a ghost in these Toyota systems. There's a ghost in the machine that doesn't leave a trace. There's not a fault code you can look to. You can't replicate it. That's the problem. It doesn't prove anything.
Toyota suggests another explanation, that the whole incident may have been a hoax, but police say there's no evidence of that at this point. Let's check the markets. Asian and European markets are down. Futures are down. The Dow gets underway at 10,624. The S&P opens at 1,149. And the Nasdaq starts trading at 2,367. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Well, here comes a story that would stretch belief even if you saw it at the movies. A rogue official at the Pentagon hires a group of contractors in Afghanistan and Pakistan, civilians that would be, and deploys them to spy on insurgents and in some cases kill them. Yet, according to this morning's New York Times, it is true. The official, Michael Furlong, reportedly referred to the group as his own team of Jason Bournes. Mark Mazzetti, correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, broke the story in this morning's paper. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
And where are you talking to us from, Mark?
I'm in New York today.
Ah, okay. Well, let's talk about this story. It is absolutely fascinating. Tell us first about Michael Furlong. He's the guy under criminal investigation, right?
Yeah, Mr. Furlong is a retired Air Force officer who now works as a civilian for the Air Force in the world of psychological operations, which is what the military calls for the use of information in warfare, using the enemy, using operations of deception and that type of thing. And
that's the famous PSYOPs, right?
That's PSYOPs, correct. And he has he's based in San Antonio at Lackland Air Force Base. But he spent a fair amount of time in the last couple of years in Afghanistan working for top commanders there. What he was doing, we're still trying to get to the bottom of. But what we report in today's paper is that he used a pool of money, about maybe around $20 million, to hire private contractors to do intelligence gathering around Afghanistan and Pakistan
for the purpose of getting rid of insurgents. Correct?
Yeah, it would be helping the military track down insurgents, get an better understanding of insurgent networks, and then, as we understand it, the information that was then fed to military operators, and in some cases, it was acted on.
So let's talk about why this is a bad thing, why it's against the law. These guys he was, Mr. Furlong, allegedly, totally off the reservation on this, correct?
Well, it's unclear, actually, whether he was a rogue, whether he had approval from commanders, whether he had approval from some commanders. That's, I think, not clear. And in the story, we're careful to say that while a lot of what seemed to have done seemed out there, it is not clear whether it was totally without approval.
So is this not against the law, however?
Well, the military operates under fairly strict rules when it comes to human intelligence gathering. The military can't just go out and pose as spies because there's a clear line between military and intelligence organizations. The CIA goes undercover. They operate as spies. What they do is deniable by the U.S. government. The military operates under much stricter rules. You can't deny the military's actions. If a member of the military is captured, the United States just doesn't let the person stop in prison. The United States gets them back. They operate under the Geneva Convention. Now, when these lines blur, this concerns people in the military because their people could be treated as spies. So, in short, it's murky. However, a lot of what Mr. Furlong seemed to have set up may have crossed some legal boundaries.
And one of the names that pops up in this story is the former head of CNN, Eason Jordan. He thought he was setting up a legitimate a website to provide information, correct?
Correct. Eason Jordan and his partner, a writer named Robert Young Pelton, approached military officials in Afghanistan in 2008 to set up a public website, public but in the sense that the U.S. government would be a client. They would pay Mr. Jordan and Mr. Pelton to gather what they called atmospheric information around Afghanistan. In other words, go around Afghanistan and find out who the power brokers are, find out who the important tribal leaders are, get critical information about how the country works, because the American military is always complaining that they don't understand how Afghanistan works. So Mr. Pelton and Mr. Jordan thought they could make some money by providing this to the military.
This operation, you report, has now been shut down, correct?
It is our understanding that, yes, Mr. Furlong's operations have been shut down. He is under investigation, although we are still trying to get to the bottom of just how expensive all this was.
Where did the money come from?
As we understand it, there was a pool of money that was given to Mr. Furlong to oversee. And this was money from, actually, an organization called the Joint IED Defeat Organization. It is the organization in the military used to counter roadside bombs. And so this organization has a lot of money to give to contractors, to give to other places in the government to try to figure out how to deal with this threat. And it's our understanding that this money came from that organization because Mr. Furlong convinced them that this sort of atmospheric intelligence gathering, this better understanding of Afghanistan, would allow the military to deal with threats like suicide bombs. So it was from it was a pool of money from the military that Mr. Furlong oversaw.
And I want to just read one quote from your article in the New York Times today. You quote one American government official as saying, quote, "While no legitimate intelligence operations got screwed up, it is generally a bad idea to have freelancers running around a war zone pretending to be James Bond." Mark Mazzetti from The New York Times, thanks for this. You and Dexter Filkins, this extraordinary story in today's New York Times. John?
Now to Bangkok, Thailand, where there's been a test of the sovereignty of the Thai government brewing for more than a week now. There are mass anti-government protests going on there this morning. And so we spoke with BBC correspondent Rachel Harvey, who was right in the middle of things, and she began by describing the scene for us.
I'm just back at the main rallying point in the old town of Bangkok, and the protesters are gathering again here. Earlier today, they'd moved from here to an army barracks, and that was the focus of several hours of demonstrations. The army barracks is being used by the government as its main command and control center while these protests are going on. So that's why the protesters have decided to go out there and make a show of force. And they did completely block the road in front of those army barracks. There were tens of thousands of red-shirted protesters. That's the uniform of choice for these anti-government demonstrators. They're waving flags, singing songs. It was all quite good-natured. These soldiers were on the other side of the iron railings in their riot gear, but it was all very good-natured and peaceful. And now the protesters have dispersed from that one point. They're coming back to this main rallying point. Their leaders are already here and up on a stage giving speeches.
And the protesters want a new election. They want the prime minister to step down, and they want to sort of reset the table here. Is there a sense that that's what the broad population of Thailand wants, or are the protesters a small group here?
The protesters are a fairly large group, but Thailand is absolutely split down the middle. It splits along rural-urban lines. It splits along class lines. The Red Shirt Movement say they are fighting for what they would call genuine democracy and for, as they would put it, a modern Thailand. They want to move the country forward, and they're fighting against, they say, a privileged establishment, an elite that are just holding on to power for its own ends. Now, the current coalition government is a pretty fractious bunch of various different parties. So the Prime Minister, on the one hand, is under pressure from within his own coalition. He's also under pressure from these protesters. And it really has been going on, these divisions, ever since the military coup of 2006, which ousted the former Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawat, from power.
Well, as you mentioned, the military coup, I mean, the army is keeping order. The military is keeping order at this point, and there are reports of attacks on military installations. Any sense that the military's patience has a limit and that they might tip their hand and support either the protesters or the government?
That is always the underlying fear here, and there have been persistent rumors of an imminent coup for months, literally for months. But the army absolutely denies that it has any such plans. It says it does still back the government, and at the moment there's no sign at all of them wanting to intervene. They have a government in place that they can live with. The army doesn't want to be seen to be intervening in Thai politics again. It did it in 2006. It really doesn't want to get involved again. At the moment, the atmosphere is still very peaceful. It is good-natured. It almost has a bit of a party feel at times, with lots of music being played. The security forces are quite deliberately standing back. They are not confronting the protesters. They're holding their ground. They're protecting main government buildings. But they're not out in large numbers where the main protest is happening. They're just letting the demonstrators get on with it. And I think that is really the strategy of the government and the security forces, that they're hoping that the protesters will eventually burn themselves out. After all, eventually, these people are going to presumably have to go back to their lives and their jobs, and a lot of these people have come great distances.
This is Rachel Harvey, BBC correspondent in Bangkok, Thailand, talking about the test to the sovereignty of the Thai government in mass anti-government protests calling for new elections.
I'm Lynn Scher, sitting in for Celeste Headlee this morning here with John Hockenberry. And coming up, is breast really best? After a long time in exile, the Formula is Fine crowd may be coming back into the mainstream. A breastfeeding update in a few minutes. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at, oh, almost 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama is heading to Ohio this morning in his campaign to gather support for health care reform. The White House hopes to get a bill passed before the president heads to Asia at the weekend. The chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, Christopher Dodd, is expected to unveil a revised financial overhaul bill today. The bill would create a consumer protection agency and expand the regulatory powers of the Federal Reserve. It does not have Republican support.
The once-in-a-decade census count begins today. More than 120 million census forms will start to arrive in mailboxes around the country. And the U.S. Treasury Department has a month to decide whether or not China is a so-called currency manipulator. But speaking over the weekend, the Chinese leader Wen Jiabao denied that the yuan is undervalued. Instead, he emphasized his concern about the lack of stability in the U.S. dollar. To get more on that, we spoke with the BBC's Chris Hogg, who joined us from Shanghai earlier this morning. And I asked him why there is such a back-and-forth dispute between the U.S. and China over currency.
Basically, China's competitors see the economy here really powering ahead, and they don't understand why, if the economy here is powering ahead, the value of the currency is so low. Since the middle of 2008, the yuan has in effect been pegged to the US dollar, and as the value of the dollar has fallen, the value of the yuan has fallen too. And that's why you get these angry comments both from the US and from the European Union too.
Are these sort of the preamble to something we might call a U.S.-China trade war?
Well, I doubt it. I mean, certainly there's a lot of anger on both sides, but I think that it's probably not likely to happen. This is kind of what happens and what has always happened. You have a lot of bad blood and complaints on either side, but I don't think there's any there would be anything to gain from either of these countries engaging in a full-scale trade war. I mean, last year when President Obama slapped the tariffs on tires, people said that was going to be the start of on cheap Chinese tires, that was going to be the start of a trade war. And actually, as the months went on, the US complaints started to taper off a little. So I think we're definitely a long way away from a trade war.
So sniping, saber-rattling, but far from an actual confrontation. That was the BBC's Chris Hogg joining us from Shanghai earlier. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
It is Monday, and here on The Takeaway, that means we talk about family. And today, a really hot topic, one that has become increasingly politicized and polarizing among moms and health advocates. And that topic, of course, is breastfeeding.
You know, it's a big issue in our house. I mean, that's what's going on.
Dare I ask?
Yes. Well, no, we are a breastfeeding household.
Well, you have a new baby and indeed. A new-ish baby. And
we've got the pump. We've got the whole thing.
So you're doing it. Well, then you know what the issues are. Over the past two decades, the mantra has been breast is best, particularly among college-educated women and older mothers. But now, John, the pendulum may be swinging back to formula is fine.
Well, there are management issues with the breastfeeding. Where I mean, it may feel good to have that sort of bonding with the baby, but managing that and staying connected to the baby on basically a two-hour tether for 24/7, I mean, is really, really difficult.
And, of course, as you know, and as I bet most of our – well, moms do need a break, but as most of our listeners no doubt know, the benefits of breastfeeding have been – touted as doing everything from preventing obesity to improving IQ.
Right. Immune system
being primary. However, lots of women have said, as you just pointed out, number one, it's painful. Number two, it complicates life in a way. I don't mean that in a flip way, but that it doesn't always work. In any event, let's talk about that now. With Dr. Phyllis Ripa-Young, she is assistant professor of sociology at Acadia University in Nova Scotia, Canada, and she is co-author of a working paper on the economic consequences of breastfeeding, something we haven't thought about before. Dr. Ripa-Young, welcome to you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Great. Now, the paper you're co-authoring indicates that all the stuff John and I have been talking about, it may be more than just stressful and guilt-laden for some mothers. Breastfeeding may also have potentially negative economic consequences. What are they?
Well, we don't find that there's an impact of breastfeeding on earnings for those who breastfeed for less than 6 months. But there is a significant and large impact for those who do it for 6 months or longer, which is how long women are recommended to do it. So these women's earnings are mostly affected because they either stop working or they move to part-time work. But my co-author, Mary Noonan, and I are only able to examine the impact of breastfeeding for those women who go ahead and actually breastfeed. It's highly possible that many of the women who do not breastfeed choose not to because they know they wouldn't be able to combine full-time work and breastfeeding, and they can't afford to quit work or they don't want to jeopardize their careers, so it may be that the average impact would be even larger than we observe in our sample.
Okay, but wait a minute. Yeah. You're saying that there's an economic downturn because the women are not available to go back to work sooner, but what about the benefits, the economic benefits? I mean, you don't have to pay for formula if you breastfeed.
Expensive stuff.
Absolutely, and we're not doing a full cost-benefit analysis, so it's very possible that that there are other economic benefits, like not having to pay for formula and all that stuff. But it's also the case that if breastfeeding were normalized, and if breastfeeding were normalized in a way to make it possible for women to carry out breastfeeding, there could be no impact at all.
Really, well, that's what surprises me, because I would have thought that workplaces are much more flexible on the issue of breastfeeding at work, but you're saying the data shows that maybe that's not the case.
No, absolutely not. I would say that despite all these exhortations for women to breastfeed, it's absolutely the case that most American employers are highly unsupportive of breastfeeding, and that really if we want people to breastfeed because people claim that there are these health benefits to it, there needs to be more questions asked, like why aren't there publicly available lactation stations? Why isn't there publicly available daycare or contributions to pensions? Because these economic penalties, they aren't just about women not being able to take vacations or having enough pocket money, but this means that women are going to have less money to put into their pensions, to put into savings, which has an impact if they're to be widowed or divorced or something happens to them.
Let's, I know, Dr. Rippey Young, that you have focused on the economic aspects of this, but I wonder if in your research you have come across the political aspects of it as well. I mean, there are groups out there who don't want to hear that maybe formula is fine.
Well, and we're not saying the formula is fine. We're not saying really what any woman should do. I think that every woman needs to make decisions about their lives in ways that make sense for them. But I think that what people should be taking away from this message is not that formula is fine, but that women should be getting angry that no matter what decision they make about breastfeeding, whether they do it or not, but they're being penalized, either financially or they're being told that they're bad mothers. And there's something wrong with that picture.
What about the economic cost of breastfeeding itself? All that equipment is expensive, right?
Sure, there are costs for breastfeeding like that. And I think that needs to be taken into account in terms of what we're asking of women, that if we're going to tell women that they have to breastfeed.
We're talking about pumps and things like that, correct?
Right. But again, we don't do a cost-benefit analysis of all of those things. We're only looking at women's earnings over time.
When you say that employers should be doing something more about this, do you believe there should be legislation, or is this something that employers simply ought to be doing on their own?
I think that there has to be legislation. I think that without legislation, employers are not going to be doing it on their own. And so I know that Representative Carolyn Maloney has a breastfeeding bill, and I think that needs to be supported. But again, I'm not telling women what they should do. I'm not trying to tell women that they should breastfeed or that they shouldn't breastfeed. But if women are going to be told that they're doing something wrong by not breastfeeding, then there needs to be something put in place so that women aren't penalized when they do what they're told that they're supposed to be doing.
And this will only keep the breastfeeding argument going and make it an even hotter topic. Thanks to you, Dr. Phyllis Rippey Young, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Acadia University in Nova Scotia. And if you want to weigh in, go to our site. We got this post from Nikki in Elkins Park, Pennsylvania, and she writes, "Forget about research. Forget about pendulums. If breastfeeding didn't work, none of us would be here because the human race would not have survived." Well, what do you think?
That. There is that.
Yeah. Join the conversation on our site, thetakeaway.org.
We want your take on the census. Census forms are starting to arrive in your mailbox. Why is it important? Why are some communities shrinking? We're looking for you to be the eyes in your town. If you left your town, why'd you go? If you're seeing neighbors leaving, why do you think the population is shifting in your town? No jobs, lack of a community, not your kind of town? Give us your reasons at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org. And because it takes only a few words to start a conversation, as we've discovered, we're looking for your help. Create the new Takeaway T-shirts with your six-word slogan. It could be anything from politics to world affairs, the economy, culture. Beginning April 12th, you can vote for your favorite. And if you're in the top five winners, we'll make the T-shirt with your slogan. What's with all the earthquakes? Here are some. won competition, got this lousy t-shirt. That's kind of mediocre. Cross the tracks, not the aisle. I like that. One of our most popular slogans on Twitter right now, unemployment is the new freelance. Maybe it's the other way around. Freelance is the new unemployment. Submit your phrase at thetakeaway.org/t-shirt. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Lynn Scherr, in for Celeste Headlee, and this is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
NYC Now delivers breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. By sponsoring our programming, you'll reach a community of passionate listeners in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to learn more.